This is a download from the BBC. For more information and our terms of use, go to bbc.co.uk/radio3.
When the stars started to go out over East London 20 years ago, I didn't think I was going blind. Planet spotting on a clear, cold winter's evening in the back garden of a Victorian terrace, I noticed a mysterious patch in the corner of my vision was blotting out the Pleiades. There's a trick astronomers use called averted vision. If you're trying to find a dim object and can't quite see it, look to one side. Aristotle noted the effect in one of his books, saying that a star just south of Sirius had a faint tail. But if you looked hard at it, the light became dim. If you looked a little away, it became brighter. My right eye was with Aristotle. My left, a lazy eye, no good for reading, but oddly more effective in the dark, confounded him. Because if I looked away, the cosmic sparks turned off. That odd patch of darkness remained mysterious, even after I'd worked my way through the menu of increasingly unpleasant tests and up the hierarchy of increasingly pleasant doctors at Moorfields Eye Hospital. "It wouldn't kill me," said the prof, but more than that he couldn't say. And as they didn't know what it was, it didn't even have a name. A small patch of nothingness at the edge of vision counts for little, given how much we all intentionally fail to see in our daily lives. And so I all but forgot it was there. As much as anything capable of eating stars could be, it seemed innocuous. But my future was set in those dark stars, much as the roots of the word disaster itself lie in the Greek words for bad star. Going blind is unthinkable, not just in the sense that few of us care to think about it. It's not something that can be imagined, only experienced. And if we don't think about blindness, we don't think about sight. It's with us all our waking life. Our memories are memories of sight. Our thoughts and dreams are driven by it. It is as insensate as breathing. Darkness is sleep, death, fear, sought only to hide secrets. Light is the world. Yet it is a conduit of more than just the physical world. It carries the major masses of our culture. It drives our emotions. To be happy is to be bright. It shapes our thoughts. To be intelligent is to be bright. It defines our hopes. From Churchill's broad sunlit uplands to mobile phone marketing, the longed-for future is bright. For sight implies light, and light is more than a carrier. It is at the start of all things. Through the telescopes that reveal the start of the godless universe, the holy books that reveal the start of our God-filled universe, it is the binding force of science and culture as revealed through our philosophies. It is the underlying descriptor of awareness and truth, the eponymous metaphor buried in the Enlightenment. Enlightenment, though, is rarely without irony, an inescapable attribute of anything that applies rationality to mankind. In 2012, I became enlightened about the true nature of my nearly forgotten visual lacuna. Over a few days, the top half of my computer screen began to sparkle, then blur. Words collapsed in on themselves. Once again, there was an escalating stream of tests and medics, this time at St Thomas's Hospital, just across from that palace of light, the Houses of Parliament. 20 years of medical advances count for quite a lot. It didn't take long for a diagnosis. AION. Anterior ischemic optic neuropathy. That's a stroke in the optic nerve with a complex set of possible causes. The main culprit was an abnormality, probably congenital, in the optic disc, which is the place at the back of the eyeball where the optic nerve burrows through. But the trigger could be any one of a number of unpleasant things, of which, once more, I had none that they could immediately detect. I had, though, lost the use of one eye, the right one, which I'd rather come to rely on. One bit of comfort was that lazy eyes could be chivvied into action, another discovery of the past 20 years, and with better glasses and a few months' training, my left eye would probably save the day. The really good news from 2 decades ago was that the left eye had already had its AION, that eater of stars, and in the history of medical literature, nobody had ever had more than two. About 4 months later, I had my third. The left eye, until then picking up nicely, started to sparkle, then dim. Without much hope, the doctors tried a massive and prolonged dose of steroids, an uncertain and by no means universally accepted treatment, but the chances were poor of saving my sight in any useful form. My first priority had been learning about my condition, which proved rare and poorly understood. About the only research being done on it was sponsored by a large pharmaceutical company which had noted a correlation between AION and the use of Viagra, one of the many risk factors which didn't apply in my case. While the details of AION are hazy, its biology is better charted. It's rooted in an evolutionary mistake in the Cambrian seas some 500 million years ago among lamprey-like fish creatures, our ancestors and those of all the vertebrates. It's among those slimy grandparents that our eyes began to appear. The eye has been the focus of many battles between creationists and evolutionary biologists, with the creationists claiming that something so complex could not possibly arise by chance. As with many such arguments, it is time-worn. Darwin himself, in On the Origin of Species, tackled it head-on, saying that the evolution of the eye by natural selection seemed absurd in the highest possible degree. But he then posited a chain of small changes, starting with the simplest possible differentiation of light from dark in a single photosensitive cell, and ending up with what we have today. Each of these tiny changes added usefully to a creature's ability to see, and thus eat better while not being eaten itself. At the time, there was little evidence for Darwin's example. It was a just-so story, as creationists then and now maintain. The fossil record, now known in exquisite detail and backed by genetic studies of substantial weight, begs to differ. Not only is there a clear path in the rocks, in fact, there's evidence for over 100 separate times eyes have evolved, but the evolutionary pathway shows that if there was a creator at work, they were careless in the extreme. For the human eye, as all vertebrate eyes, is built inside out and back to front. The creator may well have built the octopus's eye, which is logical and efficient, and of very different lineage. Light comes in through a lens, hits the retina, which signals the optic nerve behind it, and thence to the brain. In us, however, the optic nerve tunnels through the retina, enters the body of the eye, and makes its connections to the retina from the front, blocking out much of the light. It is unfair, to be honest, to call this an evolutionary mistake. In other respects, the eyes our lamprey ancestors bequeathed us contain 1,000 advances, many of which depend on that basic structure. But that basic structure remains flawed. There is complexity where the optic nerve enters the back of the eyeball, which for most people has no more consequence than the existence of the blind spot. If that structure is badly formed, if the hole where the nerve enters is too small, then the optic nerve has no room to expand. Ophthalmic specialists know this by the jaunty phrase, a disc at risk. Normally, this goes without notice and is of no consequence. But if the optic nerve becomes inflamed for any reason, the blood supply to the nerves that enter the eyeball is restricted. The nerves react by swelling still further, reducing the oxygen supply yet more. It continues in this miserable cascade until enough of the optic nerve dies off to release the pressure. After a while, the retinal cells connected to the dead neurons also decide to die through the cellular suicide of apoptosis, and the mechanism of sight across the affected areas has gone for good. This process goes on long after the initial trigger goes away, continuing over days or weeks, with no way of knowing the final account until it arrives. The observer, if they are of scientific mind, can chart the daily degeneration with homemade tests. If not, it's a matter of watching the floodwaters rise or the curtain fall, while not knowing where or when matters will come to rest. It is, in either case, a dramatic demonstration of the fallibility of nature. While comforted by the knowledge that my father, a retired country vicar, had most of East Anglia praying for me, it did not improve my opinion of creationists. So far, I was on home turf. Evolutionary biology is a copious science with many excellent communicators and an admirable rigour. But next I turn to the medical literature, which is a different story. Medicine is a land of tribes that have many different names for the same thing, the same name for many different things, and no shortage of strongly held opinions, not always on the firmest of foundations. Many doctors, even those engaged in research, are doctors first and scientists second. It is wise, I learned, to hold that in mind. But the literature was at least partially accessible, at least to someone with a high tolerance for jargon. Relayed to me through deteriorating vision It gave me a framework for discussions with my consultants. There was clarity on one point, however. There was little to be done. No miracle cure waited in the wings, or even in the pages of the tabloids. I was freed from hope, a liberating experience. I could concentrate on the story and treat it as such, and can do my best at becoming an inquisitive, receptive, and good-natured patient. I evolved my own daily routine of checking my vision when I woke up, appropriately enough AION strikes at night during sleep, and of trying to match what I saw with what I knew of the structure of sight. And what I saw, for all its unlovely implications, had its own beauty. There were, and still are, even as I say this, hallucinations, swirling patterns that drift like fern leaves on a river, unnameable colours, dark as petrol rainbows on forecourt puddles, and curious textures, like seeing through sandpaper. The geometry of the world is cut through. Straight lines are sharply severed along their length. Areas of bright colour are covered in crazed scribbles. Text morphs. Italics and many fonts become unreadable. Words with lots of vertical lines close together become a matter of guesswork. I soon found that I could not read well, in many cases not at all. Where I once could read a novel in a couple of hours, now a week was not time enough. I had become to some extent dyslexic, constantly tripped up in a thicket of shapes, and no longer able to read my own handwriting. Even my typing suffered. From being a perfectionist who delighted in giving my sub-editors nothing to do, I was serving up malformed punctuation and mutated spelling. In the parlance of my trade, I had been taken off high-speed fibre-optic broadband and put onto a dial-up modem with a noisy phone line. But this new world was full of surprises, far beyond those now delivered daily on the city streets by anarchic cyclists. For, in my new half-light, unexamined certainties about what it is to see and not see lined up for re-examination. Sight may be the paint with which we create our picture of the world and ourselves, but any painting has hidden rules to its illusion. In my new half-light, unexamined certainties about what it is to see and not see lined up for re-examination. In 1963, the abstract geometrist painter Charles Boulleau produced The Painter's Secret Geometry, a book that achieved minor cult status. In it, he applied ever more complex geometric grids to works from the entire Western canon, medieval to modernist, to show what he called the carpentry on which they were based. My decaying vision was hinting at something similar, making familiar shapes surreal, fragmenting what I was seeing into components that my mind couldn't reform into what they represented. Through Boulleau's filters, what seemed merely beautiful and true, or even obvious, reveals mechanism, structure, purpose, and artificiality. His thesis was that the geometries he revealed were part of a secret body of knowledge passed on verbally by masters to the students. But my geometries were intrinsic, passed to me through DNA and the brain's ability to wire itself up while I was learning to see as a newborn. Now, those secrets are being exposed. Sight is not seamless, and not what it seems. But it is stitched into us so tightly that we rarely question what it tells us. The light from which it is made is not the light that illuminates our thoughts. We are creatures of maps, of metaphor, not of the truth. But when we conflate those things, we risk losing the value of all of them. In the rest of these essays, I want to examine how this new and not entirely welcome perspective has changed my perception of the world, of philosophy and art, of becoming different in society, of being a patient, and of what the future looks like when you can't look at it straight on, but must, of necessity, avert your vision.